Masculinity is generally in a constant pursuit and defense of manhood. In our society, a man is expected to constantly defend and reassert his manhood or face losing it.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapists Uncensored. This is a podcast that breaks down interpersonal science into practical and understandable tidbits.
And as you listen, I can just imagine little light bulbs of insight appearing above your head.
Absolutely. You're going to be surprised and touched at what you learn about yourself as you get more accurate and in-depth view of your mind and your heart, and as you figure out those close to you.
Therapist Uncensored brings you decades of experience with interpersonal psychotherapy, relational neuroscience, modern attachment, and anything else they think will be helpful in healing humans. Now here are your co-hosts, Dr. Ann Kelly and Sue Marriott.
Welcome back. I'm Ann Kelly, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Sue Marriott. And before we introduce our guest, let's tell you a little bit about her. We are thrilled to be having another interview with Esther Perel. For those of you that don't know her, she is really such a dynamic woman. She is a New York Times bestselling author. She's written multiple books, several on sort of the erotic self and desire, and a book on infidelity and long-term relationships. And she's done multiple TED Talks that have gotten over 20 million views because she just has such an insightful, original voice on these topics in relationships. She's actually also been listed by Oprah Winfrey in her Super Soul 100 list of visionaries and influential leaders. So lots of us agree that she is a powerhouse and has a voice to be heard. And she has wanted to turn her attention more to masculinity for quite some time. But really, it hasn't been as in the forefront of other people's minds that it has hers until recently. And now with the intensity and following the Me Too movement, as well as just all sorts of cultural shifts, it really seems to be a very, very relevant topic for all of us in the world, but essentially also in the United States. And so she's come together. What we're really excited to tell you about, we're going to ask her about it. She's going to tell us about it in our interview today, but she's doing something called Sessions Live this November. She's going to do it on November 10th. It's going to be live in New York, but she's also going to live stream it. And the topic is the masculinity paradox. So it couldn't be more timely. It's long overdue, but she's going to do an in-depth discussion with top experts working with men in relationships. So with this session, she's really deepening a dialogue that really, really needs to happen. It's really focused on the concept of masculinity and how it's seen and how it has been seen and developed in our culture. And this dialogue is really about supporting change in the emotional lives of men, and that's really an essential aspect if it's inevitably going to change for women and the rest of us in our culture. So I think you're really going to love hearing from her. So let's get started. Sue, we're really excited to have Esther on the program, aren't we?
Absolutely. Welcome to the show, Esther.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So to jump right in, if three guys were to gather together and to have a conversation about femininity in 2018, sort of modern femininity, it may raise a few eyebrows. This may be a good launching point to how is this conversation different from something like that?
Like why is it that women get to speak about men?
Yeah, versus mansplaining, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Like, what gives me or what gives the women or, you know, the possibility of speaking about the other, if you want, you know, if there is such a thing as an other or others. I think I would like, actually, for men to come together and talk about modern femininity. And I think what they would probably speak about the most is their confusion. Because when I do retreats, when I facilitate retreats of men, and it's only men, it is a major subject of conversation, that confusion. What does woman want in the end? You know, the old Freudian question. So I actually would welcome men talking about women to other men in an honest way, which they don't do enough, and women talking about men to to other men and women in an honest way, which they also maybe sometimes don't do enough. So for me, organizing a conference on modern masculinity or the masculinity paradox is not about an imposing discourse. Like, I have the definition and I have the truth on men. It really is about taking advantage of a prime educational moment in our society and taking advantage of this opportunity to create a conversation. Like, nobody questions if we have a conference about children and we have a conversation where we talk about children, and no, it's not the children who are necessarily talking about themselves or the adolescents. So it's about being thoughtful, it's about being respectful, it's about being expansive and probing in our thinking. And 5 years ago, I was asked what was going to be my next topic, and I said men, and nobody was interested. And it took the societal tide wave that we have now for everybody to be interested, and I'm very pleased to be on that wave because I do think that it is one of the most crucial subjects of the moment.
Well, I love that. And, you know, another way that I have thought about it before is where we get in trouble is like when you have a power over dynamic or a competitive conversation. That's where you get into mansplaining, or any splaining, whether it be transplaining or richsplaining or heterosplaining, versus a cooperative conversation where that one really listens and tries to do a dialogue and exploration, which is, it sounds like, what we're wanting to do today and what the sessions conversation, you know, that you're trying to have.
You know, I think that if we could not speak about others, and if we were not curious about others, and if we were not interested in understanding others, we wouldn't be therapists. So this idea that only if you are of the same ilk and of the same kind and with the exact same experience can you speak, I'm not sure that that's necessarily very helpful. I think what is helpful is the attempt to try to cross lines, to go on the other side, to cross bridges, to see what life is like, and to do the best we can in understanding. No, we will never. You know, I am raising children in a country in which I didn't grow up. I will never know what it is like to be an American child, or one of the many American children for that matter. But that doesn't mean I can't have a deep dialogue over that experience. I think what me sometimes questions is the presumption that one knows better than the other what the other is about. That is problematic. Sessions, you know, it's interesting. Maybe we should explain what sessions is. For me, it has been, for the last year, a curation of an educational platform where I try to bring as broad a diversity of point of views, schools, theoretical models, disciplines of professionals working in the field of relationships and sexuality, coaches, educators, and therapists. And part of why I wanted it to be like a salon where I bring the voices of everybody that I have found interesting, that I've learned something from, was in order to actually have an interdisciplinary, cross-cultural learning platform that is not a chapel, that is not one model that is meant to answer all the issues, that becomes the primary portal through which the whole world is looked at. And in the same vein, I am organizing this annual event called Sessions Live on the masculinity paradox, where there's going to be, to me, it's everything I've wanted from a conference. It's going to be not necessarily nice and sweet. It's going to be thought-provoking. It's going to be diverse in the kinds of subjects. We're going to divide it in four pillars: masculinity in relationship to intimacy, in relationship to power, in relationship to sexuality, and in relationship to identity, which probably will be the top one. So it's these four pillars, and a look, an in-depth look at modern men and modern masculinity through these four doors.
And that is so exciting. And it is the opposite of what I was referencing earlier, which was this idea of splaining, which is someone in more power telling someone in a marginalized group what it is like to be in that marginalized group. It's the opposite of that. And where I got that from was I had seen some comments on some of the interviews that you've given on masculinity from men who were trying to make the point that it was woman-splaining for a woman to come on and talk about masculinity. which is why I started with that, about that this is different, partly because it is an inquiry and it is a dialogue and it is an open conversation. It's the opposite of a diatribe or a power over. It's your point about masculinity and the problem with masculinity, which is the power over instead of connectedness. Is that?
I feel the freedom to speak about children, about women, about living in America, about art, about men. It is a freedom of speech. I get to speak about subjects that I am interested in. I do not pretend to have the truth. In fact, most of the time I start any lecture by saying, I may sound confident, but I'm not sure of anything. I'm not right. I am gathering us here because in this moment in time, the lives of women will not change until the men come along. There is finally an opportunity for men to be able to rethink what it means to be a man in the 21st century, certainly in the West, and to be part of that the same way that I wanted men to be part of when women rethink their role at home and at work, the same way that the gay movement knew never to just demonstrate on the streets with only gays amongst them, the same way that Jews have wanted other people to be part of the acknowledgement of suffering. I mean, I have never found that there was anything useful in creating a silo that is based on the notion that I am actually so special that you will never understand me, therefore we can never really talk to each other. So the Masculinity Paradox Conference and it's streamed live across the world with people from multiple different cultures is an inquiry. It is not women talking about men. It's an inquiry in which I think we will have as diverse a group of men as possible. But I am convinced that some people at some point may still think that there was an underrepresentation of somebody. The point is not to have everybody represented. The point is to have a thoughtful conversation by people who can address the concerns, the experiences, the dilemmas, the challenges of a whole group in our society in relation to others. But it's an interesting thing. Nobody would question that if you had a conference on children. Nobody would say you have no right to talk about kids. I mean, it's like we're not there to explain children. Of course, we know that adults don't necessarily understand children, and we know that if children could talk, they would say all kinds of things. But nobody thinks of it in this notion of you are infringing a territory. You know, you are usurping the person's right to define themselves, because that's not what it is about. It really is an inquiry with a deep sense of curiosity, and the fact is that the field of relationships and couples therapy is a field that is probably 90% female. So here we are, so many women talking about men. But, you know, I was sent a picture of a program that deals with adolescent sexuality, and there was one man on the picture with 15 women on the board. And the point was being made to me, look, you know, here we are, teachers, doctors, therapists, it's all women, you know, who are trying to help men be men. And, of course, the same thing has happened in reverse for a long time, you know, where you would have one woman in a group of 10 men in a different profession, you know. So we've had this issue of over and under representation in areas where we would do so much better if we had, you know, a broad range of points of views. But I think this is what's happening now. These pictures will change. They will gradually shift the same way that there used to be pictures where you had one woman holding 7 children in her midst and a man who was kind of on the side. That too has changed. So photographs are beautiful testimonies of social change.
So Esther, you're saying that you're not trying to be the voice, that you're trying to be a voice among many, that your goal is to really deepen the dialogue among us. And I think that's just an amazing timing. It seems essential, given just the level of hostility that we're seeing experienced among the gender lines, even in relationships where people are on the same side. But yes, once we start speaking about gender roles, you can really see conflict emerging.
I don't know even if I would say that I am a voice. I would say that more than anything, I am trying to give a platform for multiple voices. I'm trying to curate a thoughtful, provocative conversation that is honest and deep and not demagogue. Yes. And that I'm going to be talking 1 hour in the course of the whole day. I mean, I am really very carefully thinking about who are the people that I have read that have some of the most interesting things to say, that may not be known, that may be young still, but that are really doing phenomenal research or clinical work or research in the popular culture, for that matter, too. I'm not only bringing clinicians. So it's very rich, you know, and I would do the same on women, and I did the same last year on infidelity. I mean, it just happens to be that I've been waiting for a long time for this subject. There is a phenomenon at this moment where, you know, on the one hand, we are in a hyper-individualized society, but we constantly feel that we are sitting in, as representatives of groups rather than ourselves. You know, the men, the women, you know, instead of some men, some women, some straight, some black, some white, you know, rather than essentializing people, if we actually could see them as members of, and that gives them a broad range of what does that membership look like. You know, there are many, many different expressions of being part of that group or that identity or that gender, however we will define it, called men. And that man doesn't have one look. Or right. Doesn't have one way of being in the world and all of that.
And I'm just wondering if, you know, for our audience, if you can speak a little bit to what, how you are defining like the modern male, or even what is to you, what is masculinity?
So I think that to me is very apparent about masculinity, has always been, is that on some level, one could say that we are born women and we become men. Masculinity is generally in a constant pursuit and defense of manhood. In contrast to being female, I would say that in our society, a man is expected to constantly defend and reassert his manhood or face losing it. You know, if I don't win, I lose mentality. I think that notion that in fact there is something profoundly fragile to the masculine identity is a very different point of view than the more blatant view of male power, rather than male power in defense, in protection, in reaction to feelings of male powerlessness. So that would be one thing I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about masculinity as an identity that has not really been explored enough. I mean, there is a code, a male code, a male box, or however, there's many words these days for looking at this in terms of how we socialize boys. And we socialize them from very early on, 3-4 years old, to disconnect from their feelings, to disconnect from their connections to others, from their needs, to become stoic, competitive, fearless, and to very much entrench their identity as boys in the concepts of performance and competence, instrumentality. And we call that the male code. Maybe when we talk about toxic masculinity, maybe this is where the toxicity lies, in the code itself, you know, not in the deviance inside the code. That code itself is very narrow, has not been examined.
Yeah, you've talked about it as the disavowal of the feminine. And one of the things that you've said that I just absolutely loved was this experience that many, many men, and about power, of this early experience of humiliation that breeds shame, that breeds contempt, that breeds self-contempt, that breeds violence, that then turns into resentment for the other person for making them feel small, that then turns into this desire to
control over the behavior of the others.
Yes. And I really loved you. It was a way of both naming the power over and the just sadistic behavior that can happen, but also having the empathy of what has happened to these men that can just absolutely really hurt other people. So I really like you calling it out, but also really putting it in perspective.
I would say that masculinity, or, you know, sits on a number of different narratives, a biological narrative and a socialization, a cultural narrative. You know, for many years now, we have separated sex from reproduction. Now we are separating reproduction from sex, and we are separating anatomy from gender. So we are reshuffling, you know, where the construct, the social construct, come in, and where is biology. The making of manhood, for me, the part that I am most interested in is primarily the cultural narrative. It is the socialization. the possibilities that we will have to expand the category called men, so that men can also live with greater levels of acceptance, of self-acceptance, and acceptance from others. And we can basically challenge what are the pressures that are being put on men. I think when it comes to the realm of relationships, women have been massively served, not all, you know, and continue to be very well served. When it comes to men, the majority of them, gay and straight men for that matter, are underserved in the realm of relationships. There is very little that is available to them that is relevant.
Oh, so relevant to like, to connectivity.
And grappling with, yes, to not being able to constantly act and perform according to code. I'm doing the podcast with you. I just did a podcast with two men, you know, also a psychology podcast. And basically, one of them was asking me in a very personal way, you know, I'm very liberal, I'm progressive. I want my partner, my female partner, to earn well. But, you know, when she was earning more than me and for so many years, you know, I can't tell you that this sat so easily with me. You know, and then there is the cultural view that wants to see this as this is great. But then there is the inside that says, you know, what is my worth? Where am I really a man? Where is my manhood actually expressed? How do I deal with the fact that she earns more? How do I deal with the fear that that means that she can leave me? Because that's actually been the way that we kept her pretty much tied at home. And, you know, it's not PC to admit that one actually has all kinds of archaic messages and legacies that live inside of us, that live side by side with often very progressive, you know, other scripts about gender configurations and gender roles. And it's that conversation that is so prime at this moment, that as together with Me Too, together with the fact that we are for the first time dealing with relationships at home and at work as a central feature and concern of our society, which we have not done till now, just right with so many options. So this is essential for clinicians and for coaches, is to really be updated and to be really thinking in very sharp way, not to exclude the man of the conversation and to say, this is a moment for you all guys to be silent and not to say a word and just to listen. To the contrary, to invite everybody into a new conversation, you know, in a fishbowl style way, if you want, where everybody gets to hear the other in a way that he or she never has. Like when you do good couples therapy, for that matter, or good family therapy. It's actually not that similar. So that we can involve with better relational and emotional training so that we can create a space for that beautiful combination between, you know, connected and strong, which is something that not enough men get an opportunity to partake in. And many of them are raised by women, after all. Not sure. But, you know, we are part of the system. And so it's multiple aspects that I think have not been really debunked and too delved in.
Now, I love what you're saying, Esther, about inviting everyone into the dialogue. I mean, there's been times when men have been encouraged to be quieted in order to listen and kind of emphasize that their privilege. But what you're saying is that everyone needs to be in the dialogue, and I really agree. And really, if you think about it, I like to voice about how women also have privilege. It's a different kind of privilege, but it's the privilege of feeling strong in emotional expression, the privilege of feeling connected and in relation to others and feeling strong and using that as a source of strength for them. So that's a different kind of privilege that women enjoy. I'm wondering, why do you think you're getting such blowback when you haven't gotten blowback in other ways?
There have been people when I wrote Mating in Captivity that had some questions about, you know, the division between love and desire and the kind of model that was not necessarily embracing an attachment perspective as the central perspective of my thinking, but more a both and. I think I have had both end when I think about love and desire or between security and adventure, like Stephen Mitchell. I've had both end when I think about infidelity in terms of what it does to you, but also what it meant for me. And I have both end when I think about how we can create a more fruitful and prolific and positive culture of gender between the genders, all the genders on a whole fluid spectrum. I think the pushback is generally from people who are more either or. When it is people who like to see both end, I think that they can see it, you know, for what it is. It doesn't mean it's the only model, but it means it's a thoughtful model. What I think is really relevant at this moment as well is that for a long time, masculinity and femininity were narrowly defined. Women have had a half a century to break open the narrow categories. And this is a moment that is actually offering that opportunity for men as well. If the 20th century was the change of the women, the 21st century will be the century where the men adapt to the women that the change, to changes that the women have made. And in the end, it is for the good of the collective. It's for everybody because it's interactive. You know, it's interdependent parts. You can't change one without the other one adapting to it. And everybody knows in systemic thinking that when there is change, there are consequences to the change. And every time before we encourage people to change, we ask them, how would they deal with the ambivalence of change? So women want men to change, but they have an ambivalence about that change as well. And that too needs to be included. And men would like to change, but they have an ambivalence about their own change because there are consequences to the change. And systemic thinking has understood that a long time. It dealt with that in family life all along, including the polarization. Every couple therapist knows to work with a polarized system. So we have something that is really valuable at this moment as therapists, as clinicians dealing with often, you know, irreconcilable narratives and perspectives and experiences to really bring into the public space at this moment. And this is where I see sessions. This is where I see the conference sessions live. And in leaving the four walls of our office and bringing some of this deep knowledge that many of us have accumulated over decades, because the society needs it. It's no longer we wait till people decide that they need us. It's that we, at this moment where relationships have become so central, you know, in ways that it never was, except when there was a crisis. And that has to do with the secularization of society and many other, you know, important social changes, that we have something to give to the collective good that I think is really crucial. And this is where the gender story enters at this particular moment. It's gender, it's power, and it's done within a perspective that is positive around sexuality as well, so that it doesn't lump everything together. It needs a sex-positive approach. I'm going to leave you with one thought that I think has really been occupying me. When it comes to relationships and well-being, personal well-being and self-care, I would say everything that is bad for women is generally worse for men. If women sometimes feel alone and gripped in silence, the silence of men and the shame that accompanies it and the isolation and the loneliness that they feel is worse because they're not even supposed to have the needs. So they're needless and they're on their own. If women deal with health issues, men's conditions about even looking for help when they have health issues is worse. Suicide is worse. Violence is worse. I mean, on all these counts, whatever is troubling women often troubles men in an even more acute way. And that is a very strange way of looking at this. It's very different from the current moment where we are very busy talking about the men at the top and how they have dealt with their privilege and their power. I think that the majority of men don't live at the top at all. And they are the sons and the brothers and the husbands and the boyfriends and the partners and the donors of a lot of the people in our society. And we need to include them in the conversation about social good.
Yes, and I've heard you say that you feel sorry for those men at the top. It's a very narrow space, and when you fall, then you're very, very small. So I really appreciate you reminding us of this compassion, because it can be so painful when you're being the one stepped on. But you're absolutely right. We have a lot to offer. And can you tell our audience about the sessions, how to find you, you know, how to link up with you to find these resources?
So everything is on estherperel.com, on my website, as well as on YouTube, on Instagram, on social media in general. Sessions is the platform. It's a monthly subscription training platform, salon, You have 2 weeks free to actually explore it and see if it speaks to you, if it's the kind of community that you want to be a part of. International, interdisciplinary, open-minded, on the edge of relationships and sexuality work. And Sessions Live is our annual event, which will be in New York City on November 10, organized this year around the theme of the masculinity paradox. And then probably if you want to know the most, my personal work, how I do it, is the podcast, is Where Should We Begin, which you find on your podcast app and all your Apple iTunes. And it is 25 couples therapy sessions. They're not my patients. They are people who apply to the podcast, but they come to see me for a three-hour consultation. And it is the first ever raw, unscripted, anonymous couples therapy podcast, so that you're literally in my office. And while you're listening in depth to others, you often realize that you're actually standing in front of your own mirror. There you will also hear me talk with the men and their partners, male partners, trans partners, female partners, about these issues of modern masculinity, but in general.
And I will tell you, Esther is a master therapist. I mean, you are making social change, but also just in the room, I can't even think of someone better. You are a master at unfolding someone and really getting to the root. So I learn from you all the time, and I know that people that work from you, oh, really, just absolutely the best.
Yeah, I agree.
A colleague of mine once said that there are two things that we learn to do without ever seeing it, which is therapy and sexuality, lovemaking. it's a unique experience to sit in the
and we get to peek in and see your therapy. Absolutely.
Exactly.
It's true. The only other exception to that is group, because I do a lot of groups, so people get to see me make mistakes and, you know, see people work in groups. So, but that is great. So thank you so much for that. It is such a gift, both to therapists and to couples that get to peek in and see this. And you're right, and identify with the couples that you're working with.
One of the other barriers that I wanted to shake up a little bit is the barrier between the professional and everybody else, and the people, and our clients, our couples, our families. Because I wrote Mating in Captivity, or The State of Affairs, to the general audience. And then clinicians also saw it as an important book, or professors, you know, to use in their work. I think the same thing is with the podcast. It's a genre bender, if you want. It's at the same time a training for therapists. I've done a few sessions with Rich Simon at the Networker, where we literally took three of those episodes and turned them into two-hour teaching tapes, blow by blow. What do I do clinically? Why? What am I thinking? And so forth. But they also are binge listening for the general audience while they're driving across the country. And to have us actually delve into the same resources is quite new. You know, things have often been divided. The therapists go to look for their professional content in one place, and the general public goes to their self-help books in another place. I think to bring us together is something that is important at this moment as well.
Oh, and Esther, that's one of the things we're most proud of, is that, you know, we're heard in 122 countries, and probably half of our listeners are therapists, but the other half are just the smart, interested public that have really been following us and following the relational sciences and affective neurobiology and co-regulation. It's just been fantastic. And we get letters all the time about what a difference it's made to bring the science to the public without, and they don't, where people who can't afford therapy or culturally aren't interested in going to therapy. So I totally agree.
The podcast, yours and others, it really is this merging that is, you know, instead of this high and low, or popular and academic, and a very interesting path to be on. Really, I commend you for that.
Thank you. You too. And, you know, people understand it and they really want it and they're hungry for it. So
I just so appreciate you being on. We appreciate you being on the program. And I love what you're saying about the podcast. And I will tell you that I often find one use of your podcast, Esther, is that when we have individuals whose husband or wife is really afraid to do couples, it's so lovely to refer them to your podcast. And it actually helps this entire dialogue happen. So I'm just wanting to tell you that the desire you have in there is actually happening. It's really wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. You. It's been a pleasure speaking with you both.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast today. Check out our show notes where Esther's contact information and books will be located. We also would love it if you could send our podcast on to interested individuals, rate and review us. And by the way, just as a reminder, we have SpeakPipe on our website at www.therapistuncensored.com. And jump on in. We would love to hear your feedback. Today's episode might have spurred quite a bit of thoughts. We'd love to hear them. And you might hear them live on the air in the next couple of weeks. All right. Thanks so much. And we'll see you around the bend.
Therapist Uncensored is Ann Kelly and Sue Marriott. This podcast is edited by Jack Anderson.